Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the IL Preps Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Ty Zanders, and we are long overdue, but Ty, there is a ton to talk about, as since the last time we talked, the Class of 2021 rankings have come out. Midnight Mania went down on September 1st, and we've already started to see some of the first commitments in the Class of 2021 come in, including on Friday morning, our number 5 ranked player, Dante Trader, committing to Maryland. But before we get to that, let's talk about the rankings. This is a really, really unique experience for you and for Inside Lacrosse, and really for the sport of lacrosse, because this is the first time that a group of rankings have ever come out when the players hadn't committed. And that's a function of the 2017 NCAA rule changes that limited first contact between college coaches and prospective student athletes until September 1st of their junior year, which meant that I believe there were 6 commitments in the class of 2021 that predated the rule changes. And now we hit the field at a relatively level playing field, and it's really exciting. So can you describe what it was like to build out this top 100 list?
Yeah, I think it was something, it was a year that I was kind of waiting on. It was a year that everyone was kind of waiting on to kind of, you know, see how the rules, you know, impacted lacrosse, you know, in a true sense, because of that timeline and so many commitments being, you know, grandfathered in the 19 and 20 classes. So, you know, to me, I think it was exciting to kind of like, almost not maybe not redo the process, but reevaluate the way that I do things and, you know, put more energy and time into it, knowing that maybe you had to look a little bit harder, you know, and work a little bit harder. And, you know, I think there's no doubt that having, you know, I would tend to maybe watch a kid that was committed to Virginia or Carolina or, you know, any big school more than I would a kid that was uncommitted or going elsewhere. And would just watch them more closely, watch them more often. And, you know, that created a product that I think is pretty different from what I currently have. There's no doubt that a commitment next to your name was a validation of that talent. And, you know, it was nice to kind of do things, you know, not looking at any commitments and just, you know, doing it in a pure sense. I think it was a fun exercise for me. I'm looking forward to kind of seeing, you know, how things shake out, what changes and where these kids commit. And, you know, it was fun to do. It was exhausting, but, you know, happy to have it over with and had a blast doing it and spoke to a lot of incredible people that were very insightful and had a wide range of opinions. So it's one of my, you know, it's my baby. It's something I take pride in, but, you know, it's something I feel very good about, you know, the product that we rolled out recently. I think, you know, I was pretty pleased with the feedback and all that.
One of the things that is really unique about this scenario is that the class of 2021 was really under-evaluated in comparison to the class of 2020 for a variety of reasons, but certainly the timeline of the rule change was a big factor in that, which meant that, say, on June 1st of this year, when the summer evaluation period started in earnest, you felt a lot of pressure. Obviously, these kids that had great sophomore years helped to elevate their stock. But, you know, not every high school team and not every high school opportunity for a sophomore is created equal. And that meant that evaluating based on grade year competition over the course of the summer was going to be really important. And so as a result, you spent a lot of time catching a lot of sun on a lot of fields. What was it like watching 21s with still having an eye on the 20s? But watching the 21s, knowing that this project was going to hit in August and trying to get a representative sample of firsthand witnessing.
You know, I think at first it was, you know, borderline overwhelming, and, you know, it evolved into exciting. You know, it was exciting at the same time. But there's no doubt that, you know, like you said, it is the most under-evaluated class, you know, as long as I've been doing this, and usually I'm used to these players heading into their rising junior summer and knowing them like the back of their hand, back of my hand, rather. You know, I think that's something that so many of us, you know, felt, you know, feels like we've been watching a guy like Brendan O'Neill for, you know, 4 or 5 years, because we have. So for the 21s, it was definitely, you know, somewhat of a clean slate, and it's exciting to kind of get out there and watch these kids, because, you know, you were just, you're learning so much. And, you know, I think it'll be even more so exciting to see who separates from the pack, you know, next year. And I know that there are a lot of, you know, certain positions that, you know, coaches view differently. And if you haven't already, check out the piece of content we put up, you know, on Thursday, I guess it was, talking, you know, having anonymous opinions from college coaches about each positional group. Because I think in general, there are certain positions, attack and face off, that I think aren't as deep as the others. And it'll be interesting to kind of see who breaks out and explodes, you know, in the spring and in the summer, because a lot can change, as we know.
So you mentioned having those conversations over the course of the month with college coaches, you know, and obviously the college coaches are not allowed to be quoted on the record talking about players until they've signed their NLI, you know, so these are all kind of for background. And you mentioned that there were some trends that emerged, but how influential was college coach feedback versus your own firsthand opinions on, say, deciding what the order of the top 10 was?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always try and set the baseline and, you know, really just compile the list of five stars, and there were 21 this year, and work on that throughout the summer, just kind of have a document. And then, you know, I had a good sense of that. I knew for a while that McAdory was going to be number one, Andrew McAdory from St. Anthony's, and that was, you know, pretty easy, and wasn't a single college coach to disagree with that. You know, but yeah, I think a lot of it, like, I knew who the top guys are. It doesn't take a genius. You know, if you watch across long enough, any sport long enough, you can tell who the best players in the country are if you watch enough. But, you know, when it comes to the order of that, I definitely, you know, lean on those guys to kind of, you know, okay, who do you like better? Would you take this kid over this kid, whatever it is? And that really helped me move certain, you know, recruits up and down. And yeah, it's always insightful. It's the aspect I enjoy the most. Certainly, a lot of hours spent on the phone, but, you know, I think that there was like, felt like there was more passion and interest in the rankings than usual, and there always is, but more than usual to kind of have that list out before the first, because I think there are certain schools that, you know, wanted to see where these kids, you know, stood. You know, I think people have understood that it is a collection of a lot of different opinions, and not just mine. So I think it was cool to kind of release that, you know, before the first, to kind of like not set the process, but, you know, kind of spice things up a little bit.
So you mentioned five stars and there being 21 in this group. What exactly does that mean? And then how is the, like, contrast between a five star and a four star made? On Thursday, you released an additional 25 four stars. And what are your thought processes on kind of moving that forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, to me, a five star is, you know, as close to a can't miss talent as you can possibly get. You know, I mean, if you're a five star, I want you to be wowing me, you know, wowing the college evaluators, maybe not 10 out of 10 times, but awfully close to that. And, you know, those are the big money guys at these schools. You know, obviously except, the Ivy League, you know, I think these are guys that are going to be getting, significant, you know, scholarships at, you know, the top programs. And, I think it, you know, the four stars definitely, you know, will be getting a lot of attention from the same schools as well. But, you know, I think I just kind of want to, you know, draw a line between a five and a four. You know, I think the five stands out every single time. The fours are right there. And, you know, kind of want to revamp and reevaluate that process, because there's a lot of talent out there. I don't think people, you know, realize that there's a lot more phenomenal players out there than just the 100 that are listed. And, you know, I did have a lot of kids on my list. About 160 were in the Excel for the 21 class, but I wanted to make it known that these players are right there. And this is an ongoing process. And as we watch film and go to more events and have more conversations and rely on what we see in person, you know, we'll add more and more. And it's exciting to, you know, be a part of that process and kind of tweak things a little bit this year.
So in the past, we have not rated players as three stars, but we have the intention to do so. And we'll kind of, with the concession that it'll be a little bit of a work in progress, you know, both implement or institute or name players to be three stars. The total number of players is still very much to be determined, as well as the schedule. And then also as well as the process of adjusting on some sort of time basis, the way that you've seen in other sports as well. So what are your thoughts just kind of like as we get going with that on, you know, kind of how you want to bring it to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, it's something that collectively as a staff, you know, we have to continue to discuss. I mean, to me, I think that it's probably fair to either not have a star or just give a kid one or two stars if you haven't seen them, and then kind of keep adding to it. You know, I think a 3-star, you know, means that you're definitely a Division I recruit. It may not be at Ivy League or you know, Big Ten or ACC, but you know, 3-star is certainly a compliment as well. And you know, to me, I just think it's the best way to kind of, you know, separate things. You know, between the 5 and the 4 and the 3, and as you know, I'm a football recruiting junkie and love the way that, you know, so many of those publications do things and kind of took that influence, but, you know, want to continue to kind of reevaluate the way that we evaluate, you know, talent, and get closer to the mainstream, you know, revenue generating sports like football and basketball. And, you know, I think we're well on our way. I love the starring system. You know, there's no doubt about that, and looking forward to kind of, you know, keep, you know, working with that.
No doubt. But, you know, as we discussed, the class of 2021 rankings were only a part of the puzzle. There was this event that we hosted called Midnight Mania on September 1st. It was held at 76ers Fieldhouse in Wilmington, Delaware. We had roughly 90 of the best players in the class of 2021 playing for a group of more than 12 Division I college coaches. It was a really exciting night. It was the second time that we had done it. You mentioned number one recruit Andrew McAdory. He was in attendance and he balled out. I previously mentioned number 5 Jonte Trader. He was there as well. Number 7 Chase Mullins. I think in total we had about 30 of the top 100 players in attendance.
9 5 stars.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. So what were your impressions and takeaways from Midnight Mania?
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. I think you know, for all parties involved, I mean, first off, just a tremendous facility, you know, making that move over to 76ers Fieldhouse in Wilmington, and getting there and just walking in, I was blown away with, you know, that whole facility, you know, and what they have there. And, you know, certainly a bonus to have a little time beforehand and hop on the Dartmouth RV and do a little, you know, do a little tour, watch some football, eat some Domino's with, you know, with that staff. So I think, you know, it was a great night, and obviously incredible to have that amount of talent in the same room playing after midnight. You know, is certainly unique in so many ways, and I think you know, I was blown away. I mean, we talked about Jonte Trader, you know, being present. Andrew McAdory, number 1, you know, was there. We had Chase Mullins, number 7, was in attendance, and some very good defensemen as well. You know, guys like Tyler Schwartz and Jake Wilson, Bobby Van Buren, and then Aiden Mulholland at midfield. I mean, there was so many guys that, you know, were the top of the rankings that really balled out. And then a couple that were not ranked that, you know, I had on my radar as giving, you know, giving 4 stars to and being in the mix for the rankings. You know, a guy like Henry Tolker was really impressive to me. You know, a Dodger out of Loyola Blakefield in the attack. I mean, he habitually made some great plays and worked really well with the rest of his unit. You know, and guys like Brandon Venerola from Mount Sinai in Team 91, you know, really had a really impressive night. And, you know, the knowns, you know, certainly, you know, balled out too, but just a couple kids that, you know, we had, you know, right there, you know, were really impressive to all of us. And I think it was certainly a blast to watch them interact with the college coaches as well. You know, I think just kind of build those relationships, and, you know, I can't thank those guys enough for being a part of it and, you know, staying up and, you know, trying to outdrink Red Bull with me, you know, and it was a fun experience across the board.
Yeah, there was a lot of coffee, a lot of 5-hour energy, and it was really exciting. I mean, you know, again, it was the second time that we had done it, and last year we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. This year we had a better sense of it, and yet the fact that it delivered when the expectation was set so high on the basis of last year was certainly really gratifying. And I think you know, one of the assets of the move to 76ers Fieldhouse was a roof. After we had survived probably like 2.5 inches of rain during
heavy downpour.
Yeah, during the 2018 event. So, you know, certainly made for an exciting night. And then one of those situations, you get back. I caught what I think was almost exactly 1 REM cycle of sleep, about 2 hours and 45 minutes. Got up, started cropping headshots and adding different types of player evaluations content and stuff like that. And before you knew it, there were some commitments that had already started to come in. So you actually tweeted the first one at the event, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were some commitments to announce that had been, I guess, solidified, whatever you want to call it. You know, that happened before the rules cycle. And you know, you wake up in the afternoon after a long night, and you're really not sure what to expect. I mean, there are a handful of commitments in the first last year. I didn't expect as many, and we've only had, I think, maybe five, you know, since the first that have been true 2021s. Yeah, I mean, you just kind of, you don't know what to expect. I just kind of woke up and started making some calls, shooting some texts out there and seeing what was happening. But I mean, I overall, I can't imagine the general excitement and the feeling and, you know, how humbling it is to be, you know, a high school kid, 16, 17, you know, whether you're a five-star, or four-star, or just whatever, you know, to have your phone, you know, to receive that attention, you know, from these schools and schools you've been watching on TV for a long time. I mean, I can't imagine how amazing that feeling was, you know, for so many kids out there. And I think that, you know, without going on too long here, and I said this on Twitter at some point, like, if you didn't get reached out to at midnight, like, you shouldn't fret. It does not mean you're not going to play college lacrosse. It does not mean you're not going to play Division I lacrosse. I think it's just, you know, there's a lot of hype around 9-1, and I think that if, you know, it's just really when the process begins, and you kind of have to be patient and realize your time will come and not fret if you don't, you know, hear from any schools out there. But, you know, I love this September 1st date, and I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what happens these next few weeks, because things will get pretty hectic. I know some big visit weekends are, you know, on the board there, certainly a huge advantage, definitely a huge advantage for the football schools, I would think. But really fun to see what unfolds.
So a couple of commitments that have already come down that I want to ask you about. So Grant Litchfield is a Massachusetts defenseman going to Johns Hopkins. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who kind of fits the mold of a Big Ten defenseman. I mean, he's not huge, but he will beat you to a pulp with his stick and really just like out physical you as a cover man for Massachusetts and Belmont Hill. You know, I like his game a lot, and you know, you can see that kind of hockey, you know, meanness, toughness that he brings to the table. I think I want to say his dad was maybe an Ivy League player or something like that, but you can see the hockey background with him, and he's just mean, and you know, I like what he brings to the table as a cover man. It's a tremendous class of defensemen, but you know, Litchfield is right there in the top 15 defensively, I think.
Kay Goldberg, a midfielder from Deerfield, committed to North Carolina.
Yeah, that's another one that had, I believe, actually could have been the first commitment in the entire class, you know, back in December 2016. Cade is from Florida originally. His dad's Jeff Goldberg, who was the head coach of St. Andrews, you know, in Boca Raton for several years, you know, around the time I was in high school, and had some phenomenal programs. Cade is, you know, undersized for sure, probably 5'8 or so, but you know, one of the fastest middies in the entire class, and just a prototypical coach's son, you know, really, you know, really, really special, feel for the game. I mean, just, you know, knew when to pull the ball out, knew when to invert, throw some gorgeous skip passes in transition, and is a clutch player. I love what he does. I mean, he's a two-way guy that can fill a variety of roles, and he's certainly, you know, at home in the ACC.
A trio of guys committed to Brown, and a couple of them planning to PG and be part of the 21 class: Forrest Dimitri, Wells Bly, and Christian Rasmussen.
Yeah, it's an interesting trio. I think for me, I've watched a lot of all three of those. You know, probably more so, you know, Bly and Rasmussen. You know, Christian Rasmussen is, I mean, he is very unassuming, but, you know, I don't think it's crazy to say that he scores as many goals as anybody out there. I mean, he scores a ton of goals, you know, as like a 5'7", you know, interior, 5'8", you know, interior finisher. And Wells Bly is a kid that can run X, can run midfield, can do a number of different things. And then, you know, Forrest Dimitri is a kid from Long Island, you know, who I think is, you know, sometimes a high-risk, high-reward kind of, you know, dodger with the way that he attacks the goal. You know, but I like what he can do with the ball and his stick, and he was someone who, you know, fared very well, from what I gather, at the Brown Prospect Day, and you know, solidified his decision, on the first.
A true 21, a defenseman from Valor Christian High School who plays for Denver Elite, decided to stay home and go to DU.
Love Trey Digby. I think very highly of him. And, you know, he is a player that, like you said, you know, grew up right in the Pio's backyard and wanted to be a part of that program. And, you know, it was a good fit for them, you know, with Coach Tierney and the way that he plays defense. But Digby, I love his game. I haven't seen a ton of it because I'm not sure if he tore his ACL or what it was, but definitely a serious knee injury at Maverick Showtime. But, yeah, just physical, press out, like, you know, long and rangy. And, you know, like what he can do. I think he's, you know, a very promising defenseman and kind of curious to see what happens to him, you know, as he recovers. You know, does he lose that, you know, that footwork and that lateral movement because of that knee injury? But a great commit for Denver.
Number 66 in the class and a four-star, Machado Rodriguez from Chaminade and Team 91 Blaze. He is a face-off guy, but what really stood out to me was his athleticism. Participated in Midnight Mania, committed to Yale on September 2nd.
Yeah, he's an interesting one in the sense that like you don't often have kids that, when they're not taking face-offs, will take wings, and I love that about him. And you know, I think it's very advantageous to have a player like that. But, yeah, he's athletic. He's, you know, kind of relentless when the ball's on the ground and just, you know, the kind of kid that you want to have on your team. And I think it's intriguing to see that Yale in back-to-back years has him and James Ball, you know, two Chaminade face-off middies. Ball, you know, recruited as a face-off guy, but ran midfield for the Flyers a lot and is, you know, really showing a lot of prowess there. So, you know, cool to kind of have that versatility there.
And then lastly, we mentioned Trader, number 5 in the class, a 5-star, a coach's son, originally from Delmarva in Delaware, Delmarva High School, transferred this past summer to McDonough, where he's playing football. He's a defensive back and just an all-around athlete, great offensive player playing at the midfield, and he committed to Maryland.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many kids that I've seen fly from restraining line as quick as Trader. And, you know, it's been a pleasure to watch. I mean, I was remarking to you earlier that I don't know if there was a kid that I felt like was improving drastically throughout the summer each time I saw him as much as Trader. And I think that, you know, that's exciting. I mean, you hear the word, you know, raw sometimes or upside, whatever it is. And, you know, you could say that he was at one point, but I think that I look at his ability and that, you know, aforementioned improvement. And that makes me feel really good about, you know, his potential as a college player. And I think when you saw him transfer to McDonough, you know, you only felt better about, you know, him panning out because of the competition and the coaching that he'll see, you know, day in, day out and practice and in games. I mean, you know, the sky's the limit for Trader. I know he's tearing it up right now in football as a safety and receiver, you know, for the Eagles. But, I mean, a huge commitment for the Terps. I know they have a couple other, you know, I think 5-stars on campus right now, you know, that are local guys. So I'm intrigued to kind of see how their class gets built out.
All right, well, Ty, that'll do it for this part of the Isle Press podcast. Stay tuned as we talk to Patrick McEwen and learn a little bit more about the club rating formula. And the IL Preps podcast continues with Patrick McEwen as we discuss one of the most recent additions to the Inside Lacrosse recruiting database, a club scoreboard. Patrick, in the spring, you created a high school scoreboard that emulated what Lax Power had established and had long been a leader in. And over the course of the subsequent 4 or 5 months, we poured probably 50,000 scores into that, roughly, and then started in earnest to develop similar type of infrastructure on the club side. And, you know, it was a little easier because we were able to utilize scores from other sources, aggregated sources, whereas we were relying on users to input a lot of the high school scores. But also, we implemented a formula that was very similar to the formula that had become accepted across the high school landscape as rating teams. Can you describe what the process of developing and populating the club scoreboard was?
So first of all, I think it's worth crediting some behind the scenes guys. It wasn't just me. I kind of the front facing, public facing, side of that development effort, but a lot of credit goes on, to guys like Wes and Mike, behind the scenes here at Inside Lacrosse. Tommy and Dan helping with the input side of things, less the development of the infrastructure, but the actual, building up of the score database. The ratings formula is identical with one kind of feature removed, actually. It's a stripped-down version. There's no home field advantage in the summer club scoreboard as compared to the spring high school ratings, as it just makes sense to assume that all those games are at neutral sites. But it's driven by the same. It's a principle that was used on Lax Power. It's a principle that's been used kind of in sports analytics and team ratings technology, you know, different systems across all sports, and has a lot of academic research behind it, that using goal differential or point differential in a game is a superior ratings methodology than to just using wins and losses. And there are reasons to use that, like the NCAA and the RPI uses wins and losses only. For, you know, reasons we don't need to get into here. You know, we're fortunate to be able to, with so few games over the summer, teams playing in sometimes two tournaments, maybe 10 games, 15 games over the course of a summer, we really don't have that much information about the teams.
So why turn away valuable information like the final score?
Right. And I think that does introduce a few complications, I think, relative to the high school scoreboard, in that in the summer you have teams that, first of all, the overall structure of it is different than the spring, because you have kind of clusters of games at tournaments where teams in the same age group at the same tournament are all playing a lot of games against each other. So we get a very good sample size of how those teams relate to each other on that weekend. But then you get situations where maybe a team is missing a couple players the next weekend because they're at an individual event, showcase event, like the Under Armour underclass games or something of that nature, or guys get hurt or they're, you know, missing for whatever reason. Kind of throws things off a little bit in a weird way. And there's, in some cases, fewer connections between, like, East Coast and West Coast tournaments, that you have West Coast teams like West Coast Stars that come play on the East Coast, but they don't really play in any California tournaments, even though that's where they're from. Whereas in the high school in the spring, every team is playing at least some of their games in their home area, playing a lot more regional games. So you get kind of a much more connected web of games across the country that allows us to make relative judgments about who is better than who.
Which, you know, really put a strong and heavy burden on gathering as much information as possible, and really showed itself to be kind of the main threat to the matching of the objective output to the subjective opinion, right? And so as a result, you and the group worked hard to find different tournaments and different games that teams played in where it continued to create connections between different clusters or nodes of games, and that helped to bring the results of the rating a little bit more in line with what the expectation was, right?
Yeah, exactly. That it's just always, you know, discussing of, we had to find a tournament that this team played in that connected to another team to get us, you know, from the East Coast to the Midwest, you know, out to an event in Colorado like the Denver Shootout, you know, that West Coast teams are coming into play in, who maybe wouldn't make the trip all the way to the East Coast, but are coming more kind of in a multi-state region to play regionally. The other thing I was going to say is that with teams playing, you know, sometimes three games in a day, kind of teams and coaching staffs are a lot quicker to kind of call off the dog, so to speak. And that in a spring situation where you're playing one game a day, and you know you often almost always have a rest day afterwards or 2 days before your next game, you're gonna you know, keep playing hard until you're up by 8, 10, 12 goals. In the summer, sometimes there's 5 minutes left and you're up by 2 or 3 goals. You're going to save your legs knowing that you have a championship game to play, and it's your, you know, third game of the day. And so I think that leads to or cases where maybe in the last game you missed the playoff format and you have a consolation game the last day. And as much as you like to say you play hard every game, the effort sometimes in a game that you know is a consolation game isn't the same effort when it's your seventh game in 3 days, as opposed to a team playing in a championship game of a tournament. And I think that leads to some wonky results sometimes, which I think are... Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to build on the point about wonky results, which is to say, like, so this is a tool that has a lot of different motivations and potential outcomes. Mm-hmm. So one of the motivations is greater clarity among who's good and who isn't as good. And we think, by and large, that goal has been accomplished. There's some issues that need to be ironed out. And that's where one of the other motivations is maybe a tool like this that increases clarity and, for lack of a better word, accountability, can help to iron out some of the issues that have nothing to do with the scoreboard, the formula, the rating system. They have to do with the infrastructure of summer club lacrosse. There's no question that the influence, power, and importance of summer club lacrosse has increased dramatically over the last 10 years. But that doesn't mean that it is a perfect system, and some of the things that people would like to see could potentially be brought along by virtue of this increased clarity and increased accountability, such as, say, roster faithfulness.
Exactly. That's one, another point I was going to make, is you have, as we kind of have been going through this process, asking, you know, talking to club coaches about why their teams are rated somewhere, is you have teams that will roster more than one team's worth of players, and it's not a, there's not truly two separate teams, but they're not always bringing their best players to every tournament. And that obviously is reflected in the ratings, that if you don't bring your best players to every tournament, you're probably not going to end up rated as highly as maybe you feel like you should be. It's a reflection of what happened in the summer, not necessarily what would happen if every team had their best players playing their best lacrosse. And that's one I don't know that it's necessarily good or bad. And that's why I think when you look at it, it's not, I don't think anybody's trying to claim it's a definitive rating of the team that's number one in the formula is definitively better than the number two team. It's, they ended up better in this metric.
And this metric is better than anything that we think or are aware of exists in the market.
Yeah, in terms of objectively measuring the performance of summer club lacrosse teams. You know, we think it is the standard. Another thing, too, to think about when you look at it is we give you the number ratings. And there are ratings that you're familiar with if you've looked on either our spring ratings or on Lax Power over the years, where a team that's a 94 is projected to be two goals better than a team that's a 92 at a neutral site. And, you know, anybody who's familiar with college lacrosse or gambling lines, you know, a two-goal team being favored by two goals is by no means a guaranteed win. That I think you'd expect maybe a team is favored by two goals to win 2/3 of the time, 70%, 60%, somewhere in that realm. So it's, you know, it's upsets do happen. It's reasonable, you know, that one or two goal difference isn't huge, even if it appears as 50 or 75 ranking places, that it's totally conceivable the 75th best team could beat the 25th best team. Just because the distance between them isn't that large.
And that's a really important point, right? Because there's a number to a left to the left of a team, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. And then there's a number to the right, which is 88.71. And the number on the left is, it's a set separation in degree, right? The number on the right is really what illustrates what separates two teams. And to your point, there are a lot of factors that go into it. So I think that's one of the things that, you know, we need to say most loudly, because it's one of the things that people might not necessarily realize or assume. And I think that that's an important feature of the output.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's obviously reading left to right. You know, it's natural that people, and, you know, it's kind of the fault of the way it's put together of the number on the left, the ranking. Gets talked about more because it's easier for people to digest. You know what the 10th best team in the country is or the 25th best country. It's harder to grasp what does being a 96.42 mean.
Right.
Is much more abstract. But if you want to talk about how good teams are, that's really, I think, the number you want to be looking at. That when you explain, you know, when you think of it as, well, they've been about a goal better than you this summer. Doesn't seem that big of a deal.
Right.
It seems less of a big deal than saying, oh, they're ranked 40 spots higher.
Right. So just to wrap this conversation up, you know, obviously there's so much more that we could discuss in terms of our plans and where we want to see this go. But prior to this, you wouldn't have claimed to be an expert on who the best teams in summer lacrosse were or are. So I think that it's valuable to, you know, kind of hear your reaction to the reaction. You know, obviously the entirety of this conversation to this point is the type of education that we're trying to provide around what this product actually is. But what have you heard or seen that, you know, has given you an indication as to, you know, how valuable, credible, or meaningful this output is?
I think the biggest one is I think I've learned that a lot of people think that their summer club team is as good as they are when they're at their best, but then cite results of other teams when maybe those teams weren't at their best to justify it, that everybody's kind of vision in their own minds of their team is what their team is at their best. And it's one of those, I think this provides a bit of a reality check of the team that you were over the course of the summer wasn't always your team at your best. And that's what we're rating, is what happened, not what your team could be.
And that is also true for your opponents. And so everybody kind of has an equal footing in that regard, right? Like you don't get to cherry pick which are your opponent's results that illustrate a version of reality that is more favorable to you.
Exactly. That everybody knows when you had your guys and when you didn't have your guys. And so to say that when we had our guys, we beat this team, you don't necessarily know, did they have all their guys on that day? Or, you know, were they whatever, you know, how many games, you know, what game of the day or how much did they care or what the deal was with them at that moment? And so I think it's fine to, you know, view your team, you know, your fond memories of the summer, remembering what your team was like at their best. That's how I look back on my high school lacrosse days. I'll tell you all about all the games we won where we played great, and just, you know, kind of neglect the games where we may not have played so well and lost.
Well, it certainly is a fun addition to the club landscape, and one that, as the November season approaches, we're excited to be able to update more in real time and see the picture change as the results come in. We are turning over our season. We are grouping the fall of 19 together with the summer of 20. And so that means that the slate gets wiped clean when we reset our website. And it's going to be awesome to follow.
I hope so. I hope you guys keep following along. Feel free to tweet at me if you want to complain. That's what we should also maybe clarify to people, that oftentimes when people are very used to, when there's inside lacrosse summer club related rankings, that they go and complain to Ty, to my colleague Ty Zanders, that you can do that with the summer club ratings, but all he's going to do is go around and tell me. Because he has no ability to fix them or make any changes. So please
hit him up at Lax Film Room on Twitter primarily, but also Instagram, right? Do you check your DMs on Instagram? There you go. Maybe not. Maybe let's go to Twitter.
Twitter is definitely the better way to go.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for listening to this edition of the IL Preps podcast. Follow at IL Preps on Instagram and Twitter. And we will be back next week with more as we get ready to launch the bulk of our 2019 Inside Lacrosse recruiting issue.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.